Well, good morning. Is it just me or is it a little warm in here today? It's the Holy Spirit, yes, but it's also this baptistry back here that's about 90 degrees and we're going to baptize some folks when this service is over, so I hope you'll plan on sticking around for that. My name's Brent. I'm lead pastor here at Ashworth, and we're really glad that you're here with us today. We're in the middle of a series, as you can see on the screen. We're calling this Unfinished, Continuing God's Work in the World. And every Sunday, what we're doing is we're just kind of asking the question, what happened after Jesus physically left the earth? We know he died, he came back to life, he was resurrected, but he also physically left the earth and kind of left the work to be done to this ragtag group of people that actually includes us today. And so we're trying to figure out, what does this look like? What does this mean? How are we to continue God's work in the world? And so this morning, we come to a place in the book of Acts where something really interesting starts to happen, and it's not going to be surprising because I think we all have been here and experienced it. Anybody ever experienced growing pains in your life, in your family? You know, any of you remember going into adolescence, puberty, that wonderful transition of life where your arms get longer and your feet get longer or your legs get longer and you have to learn how to walk all over again because you're tripping on your own feet? And, you know, it's funny when it's somebody else, but not nearly as funny when it's you. Or maybe, you know, you have growing pains in your family. You have a child and you're fine and you're comfortable, and then the second child comes along and you're like, oh wow, I don't have enough room for all this baby stuff anymore, and so we have to move. And then you go from 3 children to 7 children, and it's just like, wow, this is so awesome. But these are growing pains. These are growing pains, and we all can relate to this. We've all experienced it somewhere in our life. And as we turn our attention to the book of Acts today, we're going to find out that even in the early church, they too experienced a lot of growing pains. And great for us, it was written down, and we can look and we can say, how did they deal with this? Because we all know, whether it's a family or whether it's any type of organization, but especially a church, when you have different people involved, when you have more than one person involved, and you experience growing pains, you experience challenges and difficulties, and things aren't smooth sailing, we all know that we all get a little tense, right? I mean, we all kind of like, oh, something, ooh, what's going to go wrong here? Is this thing going to go off the rails? I mean, that's kind of the question. Because when you have people with different backgrounds, different ages, different nationalities, we know there's always the potential for disagreements, misunderstandings, conflict. We're just human. And we know when we begin to interact, we come at things from a different perspective and different angles. And we know that this risk is there for us to not get along. So we're going to turn to Acts chapter 6 today. And we're going to see that in this very new thing called the church, that's exactly what began to happen. You know, I think we often forget, or maybe we just, you know, don't think about it. But when we read the book of Acts, we are just weeks and months and maybe a few years removed from when Jesus left. You know, and here are these people that their initial experience was Jesus saying, hey, you want to follow me? And they're like, sure, I'm not doing anything else, so let's go. And Jesus is teaching and Jesus is saying, hey, go and do this. And so they did this for like 3 years. And so this was the style that they were used to. And then all of a sudden, Jesus is gone. The Holy Spirit's come, and that's a whole crazy kind of thing, right, where they're trying to figure this thing out. And so in this moment where we read in Acts, they're just trying to figure this out. They're trying to figure out, what does this look like? What does this mean? They knew the Jewish system. They'd gone to temple. They were praying multiple times a day. I mean, because most of the people at this point had come out of that Jewish religious system. But they're trying to figure out, what do we keep? What do we get rid of? What carries over into the new system? And who do we follow now? Who's going to speak for us? Is there somebody in charge of this thing? Is it just a free-for-all? And it would be nice if Jesus had left an instruction manual. As much as I would like to tell you, oh, I'm a throw-the-instructions-away kind of guy, I'm really not. I want to see the instructions. I mean, I've kind of discovered the hobby of woodworking. I get to do that occasionally. And to be honest, the best thing I love about it is when I can find a plan that I can follow. And I'm not the creative type. That's my wife. She can dream up things out of the air and just be like, put it together. Not me. I want to see the end result. I want a step by step. Step one, cut this board to this length. Perfect. I'm there. I think in church, I would have loved it if Jesus had done that for us as well. Hey, guys, step one, do this. Step two, do this. Only he didn't. Why not? Jesus knows us, right? I mean, he knew what he was leaving it in the hands. Why would he not do this? It just kind of boggles my mind. I was reading this week, there's a scholar and an author today named N.T. Wright. Anybody familiar with N.T. Wright? He's one of the foremost theologians of our time. Excuse me. And he was approached years ago about writing a book. And it was going to be called Jesus at 60. And the publishing company basically said, we want you to write a book and under the idea that Jesus didn't die when he was 30 or 33 or whatever, that he lived another 20 to 30 years. And we want to know, what would that look like? If Jesus had been around, how would he have done things? How would he have organized things? Because, you know, in 20 or 30 years, he would have had to have moved beyond what he was doing into this new way of doing things. And if you're a fan of N.T. Wright, you're going, I don't remember seeing that title anywhere. And you are correct, because he refused to write the book. Because he said, number one, that wasn't Jesus's priority. Jesus didn't come to set up a system and a structure. He came to do what he did, to inaugurate the kingdom of God. But he also said that there's a false premise here in thinking that it would take 20 or 30 years for Jesus to have to set up a system. Because as we look at Acts chapter 6 today, it only took weeks before us. I mean, and we can criticize them, but we know if we were there, we'd have been doing the same thing. It only took weeks before this thing started to really potentially go off the rails. And today what I want us to look at is, what did they do? How did they respond when they started experiencing these growing pains? And so if you remember, if you were here last week, we looked at Acts chapter 3 and 4, and we talked about divine opportunities and opposition comes up. And so Peter and John, they'd been arrested. They're told to stop talking about Jesus, and they said, we refuse to listen to you. We're going to listen to God. And so they continued to speak. And as you read through Acts 3, 4, 5, you see that the church just continues this incredible astronomical growth. I mean, these apostles, these early disciples, they are bold in their preaching and teaching of Jesus. And as people hear that message, they are just like, I want to follow Jesus. And so they don't have this incredible marketing strategy. I mean, to be fair, they probably don't even have a plan at all, except to just say, tell people about Jesus. And one after one, person after person begins to follow Jesus into the thousands that continue to follow Jesus. Miracles are still happening, which are amazing. The apostles are experiencing more persecution. And then when you read in Acts chapter 5, they're like, and we love it because we think it's an honor that we are persecuted for Jesus. And I'm thinking, I don't know that I'm there yet, but okay, they were. It's good. And then we move to chapter 6. Where we find out that the growing pains that the church is going to experience aren't necessarily problems from the outside. They've experienced that opposition, and they're like, we don't care, we're moving forward. But now some of the problems begin to pop up on the inside. And so when we read in Acts chapter 6, and we start reading at verse 1, listen to what it says. In those days when the number of disciples was increasing. Now, as a pastor, that's the best thing you could say about your church. I mean, that's what we want. We want a growing, healthy church. And in these first 10 words, everything sounds great. Man, this is good. People are coming to know Jesus, the number of disciples they're following. It's growing. This is great. And then you read more and you know that everybody's wanting to help everyone out. They're sharing what they have. People are committed and they're going forward. But let's keep reading. Keeps going, it says, the Hellenistic Jews among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. You see, this is where N.T. Wright was correct. It didn't take 20 to 30 years for the thing to start getting wonky and people start to complain and the potential for this whole mess to just go away. It was just weeks that it happened. You see, in this culture, it was common when a husband died that typically the husband would leave things set up for the widow, that the widow would be fine and be taken care of. But in some instances, it didn't happen. There was no Social Security, not necessarily a retirement plan. And so there could be widows that were of an age that were not going to get remarried, because they encouraged the young widows, go find you another husband. But, sorry, women, this was not your era to live in, so just keep that in mind. But if you were older, you couldn't get a job. What were you going to do? And so in the Jewish system, it fell to that community of faith to take care of them, and they did. They took care of them. They fed them. They did whatever was necessary to make sure that these members of society were not neglected. But if you were a Jewish woman and your husband had died and you then decided to follow Jesus, you were cut off from that entire support system. That whole community that would normally have been there to surround you and take care of you, they shunned you because you weren't part of them anymore. They said, you're a Jesus follower, you're out. And as we think about that today, we think, how could you be so cold and uncaring? But it still happens today. When people choose to follow Jesus, we don't experience it much in our culture, but around the world, in cultures that are represented here in this church today, it's still a very real reality. And so these women, they were deciding to follow Jesus, they were giving their lives to Christ, and so they're in this new fledgling thing called the church, and things are happening, and things aren't happening, and things are not going as they should. But we do read that the early Christians recognized the need, and they thought, we will step in. We will take care of the widows among us that are following Jesus. We'll do that. But as it was growing so rapidly, as people outside that normal community started to come in, there began to be a little bit of a rub. There began to be a little bit of, I may not look like you, talk like you, act like you, so are you still going to take care of me? Because here in this passage, we read there are two different types of Jewish women, widows, that are talked about. There are the Hebraic Jews, which are the Hebrews, which are those in the Hebrew culture, those that spoke Aramaic, those that were part of that system and culture. But you also had the Hellenistic Jews. Those were, you could say, Greek Jews. They spoke a different language. They spoke Greek instead of Hebrew. They were immersed not in the Hebrew culture. They were immersed in the Greek culture. And so they did things differently. They acted differently. They didn't necessarily go to the temple and do all the things that the Hebraic Jews did. And they're all coming together in this church situation, this church environment. And they might have looked the same on the outside, but they were very different. And what's happening is one group looks at the other and they say, they're getting taken care of. Why aren't we? So let's keep reading. So the 12 gathered all the disciples together and said, it would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of the word of God in order to wait on tables. Brothers and sisters, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them, and we will give our attention to prayer and the ministry of the word. This proposal pleased the whole group. They chose Stephen and a whole bunch of other names that I'm not even going to try to pronounce. They presented these men to the apostles, who prayed and laid their hands on them. So the word of God spread. The number of disciples in Jerusalem increased rapidly, and a large number of priests became obedient to the faith. You see, as this new church is taking off, it did not take long for the new shine to kind of wear off, and all the growth and the challenges began to create real issues. You see, what the women that were complaining, there was a real legitimate need there. This wasn't something they were making up. No, they're going hungry. They needed food, and it was customary for the community to take care of them, and their community was not. And when they looked at it, they looked and they said, oh, but you're favoring one group over the other. But I will point out that we have no indication that that was intentional. There was no indication that the disciples or anybody in the church said, well, we're not going to take care of them. They're not like us. No, I think what we have here is an honest mistake. It's just the church is growing. Things are moving at a quick pace. And you know what happens sometimes? Things fall through the cracks. Things get missed, balls get dropped, whatever expression you want to use. And it's not intentional. It's not malicious. It's not, you're not doing it on purpose. It just happens because it becomes too great for you to keep your hands all around. You see, and as the apostles, I imagine in this moment, they're preaching and teaching and they're trying to build up disciples, but they're also trying to do other things and their hands just get too full. And they recognize it. And they say, you know what, we're going to have to address this. But before they address it, the people do start complaining. You see, these growing pains for a church can present themselves in a lot of different ways. It can be changes in the outside, what's happening outside the church. A culture that maybe is no longer as favorable to the church as it used to be. You know, just for example, and when I say this, I'm not bemoaning this, and I'm not griping it, but you know, I grew up in a day where we had blue laws. Anybody remember blue laws? You young people up front, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It was a law that said stores could not open on Sunday. I see some head nods. Yeah, there was actually, yeah, Garrett, there were actually laws. I love getting facial reactions sometimes. There was actually a law that said you couldn't, and I remember when this started changing, because then what happened? They said, oh, well, you can open at noon and close at 6. Now, why noon to 6? Because you got out of church before noon and you had to go back after 6. So they made sure. But I can remember if you needed gas, if you needed stuff at Walmart, you went on Saturday because you weren't getting it on Sunday. Schools protected and guarded that weekend experience. The idea of a baseball tournament on the weekend would have been unheard of. Amen. Some of us want to go back to that day. Wednesday nights was a protected evening. Teachers wouldn't even assign homework on Wednesday because they knew you needed to. Some of these, you're just like, oh, please, let's go back to that day. No, you didn't even get homework. Now, as a church, we can look at this and we can go, well, doggone it, that's wrong. We're mad about it. We're just going to post on Facebook how mad we are about it and tell you all how pagan you are and you should love Jesus more and quit doing that. Or we can respond and we can say, this is just where culture is. We're going to try to push when we can, but we're not going to sit here and create an us versus them mentality that says we're going to tell you how horrible and evil you are. We're going to figure out how to work with the change that's happening, because the changes we've experienced in my lifetime have been huge, and I'm sure that the changes that will happen in the next 20 to 50 years will be even greater. See, the question is, we're going to face these growing pains, but what will we do when we face them? And sometimes those growing pains are outside of our control, but sometimes the growing pains are within the church. You may not know this, but I've been the lead pastor here for almost 7 years. And when I took over, the church at that point had about 100 people that called Ashworth home on a Sunday. You look at everybody that calls Ashworth home now, we're close to 300. Things have changed. I think for the better. I think things are good. But it means that we have to respond to what's happening. And maybe as I say that, you think, oh, so that's why I don't get the same level of care from the pastor that I used to get. Yeah, that's it. I'm just going to be blunt. When I had 100 people here, we were doing this. It was easy. I can't juggle, so I don't know if that's the right motion or not. But when you get 300, it gets a lot more complicated. The question is, what are we going to do when we experience growing pains? And I think as we look to the early church, they lay a great foundation and a great model for us to follow. And there's basically three things that I pull from this story today that I want us to just kind of internalize a little bit. And as I talk about these, ask yourself the question, where am I at on this specific issue? Because I think it's easy for us to go to one side or the other. And the first one is just simply this. It's the urgency of unity. You see, when the apostles were presented with a problem, they had a couple of different choices. They could have said, oh my God, those Hellenistic Jews, they just complain about everything. Tell them to suck it up and get over it. And you know what would have happened? Split. That group would have very easily split apart. But they didn't say that. The apostles recognized the value of unity. And what's so interesting is if we were to think about that, if that split had occurred, it wouldn't have been over a serious issue like theology, like one group saying Jesus is God and one group saying Jesus is not. It would have been over food, a very practical issue. And isn't that how it goes sometimes? Because when we think about church, it's very easy for us to push our preferences into a very global setting. And when our preferences don't seem to be considered or our needs seem to be ignored, we can begin to tell ourselves a story. And I think that's what happened here. Because when the Hebraic Jews are being cared for, if you were on the outside, it would be very easy for you to look and say, well, they just like them better. We're not as important as that group of people. You see, that's what happens sometimes. We allow our emotions to overwhelm us. It's how we're created. But we have to realize that immediately we begin to tell ourselves a story. Have you ever seen that before in your life? Somebody says or does something and immediately you're like, well, they did that for this reason. And you jump there, whether it's true or not, because your emotions have taken over and that story is being written in your head. When we begin to tell ourselves a story, we fall into a dangerous trap of allowing our emotions to define reality. And that can lead us to some very destructive behavior. Anger, saying things we shouldn't, spreading our version of the story without checking into its validity. In the church in Acts, we know they didn't have a healthy response to what was going on. Now, there's a legitimate need, and there was a need for conversation to take place. There was a place for this to be talked about. But when Luke writes this in Acts 6, he uses the word complained, and I love this word because it's also referenced. It's kind of the same word that's used in the Old Testament, and it has this meaning behind it, to murmur. You know, when Moses is leading the Israelites out of Egypt and towards the Promised Land, they started murmuring. There's just all this. That's the idea that is taking place here. It's just this constant, yeah, yeah, and, oh, it's all how bad, terrible, ho, boo, 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 boo. And it's horrible. When you look and you see what word that Luke is using here in the Greek, it's not a pleasant word. You don't want this said about you. And even though there was a real need falling through the cracks, there should have been a conversation, and complaining cannot be our go-to response. Complaining will destroy unity. It creates factions, and it destroys what God is trying to do. And when we give in to complaining, I'm just going to say it as bluntly as I can, you are being used by Satan. Again, there's a way to have conversation, but not complaining. And we all know when it happens because we'll see those little pockets, and maybe you get that little pocket of your friends and it's like, did you hear what that pastor said? I can't believe he said it. We've got to get rid of him. I'm sure that's a conversation that's been said many times over 7 years. I wouldn't blame you. But when we fall into that, when we give into that, we are building into disunity, and we are being used by Satan to destroy what God is trying to build. We cannot allow grumbling to ever be our go-to response, because it's not ever an appropriate response for somebody following Jesus. We can't allow the story we tell ourselves to believe the wrong things about someone just because they're different. You see, this was what was taking place. They had a different culture. They spoke a different language. And so right there's this tension that exists. You see, but church must be a place where diversity is welcome. We need to display this to the world, that there can be unity in diversity. And good God, is there not a need for that in our world right now? I mean, we live in a world that says, if you don't believe all 100 things that I believe, I have to hate you. Garbage. Why is the church not leading the way in showing that in our diversity we can find unity, and we don't have to hate one another just because we're different? See, we always have to be on guard against these stories we're going to tell ourselves, anything that will threaten our unity. Whether it's the carpet color or music styles or ministry and the way it should be done, we can't let those things derail us and to allow an un-Christ-like prejudice to take hold. Because the fact is this, God is bigger than the problem we face, and what unites us is deeper than anything that divides. And the moment we don't believe that is the moment we take our eyes off Jesus. Period. Unity There's an urgency for unity. The second thing I think we see in this passage is when the church begins to grow and change, service comes to the forefront, and we see the significance of service. The early church, they responded by selecting seven men. And while in this passage they're not specifically called deacons, and some people make the case these are the first deacons or they're not, it doesn't matter. It certainly lays the foundation for a role in the church to help make sure people are taken care of. But we have to be careful here, because what I find fascinating is what they did, they needed to respond because there was a gap in the ministry. But if we really understood, if the church was doing what the church was called to do, there would never have been a need for these men to be selected. Think about that. If the church was stepping in, taking care of one another, there would never have been a need for a special role to come in and say, okay, you guys make sure these people aren't falling through the cracks. You see, what happens sometimes is we see roles in the church, pastor, deacon, small group leader, whatever, and we use those as an excuse to say, well, then I don't have to. Well, we have deacons to call and check on people, then I don't have to. We have a pastor who can lead people to Christ and disciple them and baptize them and whatever else them, so I don't have to. You see, if we're not careful, these growing pains will turn us into consumers rather than owners. And what I love about this is that they step in and there is a need and they respond to the need and these individuals step up and step into. And when we experience growing pains, serving is significant, but it's not just for a select few who have a title. We all should be servants. And to understand this, we just have to think about how the church is described in the New Testament. It's described as a body, with everybody being a part of the body and every part doing its thing, or we're referred to as a family. We all have a role to play. And when one part decides it doesn't want to do its job, the entire family, the entire body suffers. You see, what's taking place here in the first church is right up my alley. It's administrative. There was a need, and they needed to make sure that the ball didn't get dropped. So they prayed, they identified seven individuals who were already serving, and they set them apart to make sure it didn't happen again. This wasn't a power position. In fact, it's just the opposite. The word here that's used for deacon, diakonos, is actually the term for a servant, a waiter, a table waiter. It's the person who serves the food, clears the table, does the dishes, and takes out the trash. Who wants to sign up today for that job? It's not the glorious position of pastor that gets to stand on the stage, right? No, it's a servant. But beyond that, these were individuals with good reputation, good character, inside the church and outside the church. When people thought of these individuals, they thought, man, that's just a good person. They lived their life with integrity, and they were spiritually minded, full of the Spirit. And even though they're not technically deacons, it might lead us to the question, though, that we need to ask is, why would we have deacons? What would deacons do? And who can be a deacon? And these are all great questions. And you know, if you're a part of Ashworth and you get our wonderful weekly email, these are questions that we've been wrestling with over the last year. These are things that we've realized that, just like the first church, we've got some cracks that need to be filled here in our ministry. Why would we need deacons here? It was the same reason as the first church. We've gotten to a place where the care of our people within the church is too much for one or two pastors. We have to make sure that people in the body get taken care of. Doesn't let any of us off the hook. It still means we all get to serve, but it puts a system in place to make sure we don't drop the ball. And it makes sure that the pastors are freed up to do just exactly what the apostles did, which is to turn our attention to prayer and the teaching of the word. And that's critical. What do deacons do? The same thing they did here. They care for the body. They make sure the needs are taken care of. And who can be a deacon? Well, here they selected seven men, but elsewhere we read that it's men and women that were selected to serve in this role. Romans 16, we're introduced to a woman named Phoebe who was a deacon in the church. 1 Timothy 3 lays out qualifications which remind us that the selection of deacons should never be a popularity contest, but driven by those who know Jesus and follow him, are godly in their character, and people who already give their lives in service. But there's another question here too. Brent, isn't that your job? you're about 25, 30 years ago, the answer would probably be, yes, it is. And many people would look at the pastor and say, that's what we pay you to do. But the best response I have is the same one the apostles gave. I said it earlier. My job is not to be the hired holy man running around this place doing everything for everybody. My job is to pray. You pay me to pray. You pay me to teach the word, and you pay me to equip you to be able to do the job that God's called you to do. It's not that one job is more important than the other. It has everything to do, not with importance, but with calling. And we need to remember that when it comes to serving one another, Jesus is the ultimate model. What did Jesus do? He took the towel and he sat on the floor and he did the job of a slave when he washed his disciples' feet. He was the ultimate servant, laying down his life, going to the cross for us. We need to remember that each of us for serving is significant. And if it doesn't happen, people will be neglected and forgotten. Last thing I want us to see here is that the church had to do what they did. The church had a choice. They could have just sat in this moment and said, by God, we're not going to move. We're not going to change. We're going to do what we've done for the last 50 years. Well, there weren't 50 years, but, you know, we've never done it that way before, and we're going to keep doing what we've always done. But they didn't do that. You see, those outside the church were hearing about Jesus and deciding to follow him, and the church grew by different ages and nationalities. People with different skin color and languages were coming in, and the church had to determine, will we adapt and respond to what is going on, or will we not? You see, the one thing we know is that change is certain. Change is certain. Think for just a moment. What if in this moment the church had made a different decision, if the apostles hadn't decided to set aside seven men? What if they'd have said to themselves, you know what, those widows are right. Peter and John, we're gonna pick this up. We're gonna serve food. We don't have time to pray. We don't have time to tell other people about Jesus. We're just gonna go serve food. What would have happened? Do you think you and I would be here today? Probably not. Because they had to free themselves up to continue telling people about Jesus. Otherwise, they could have just stopped telling people about Jesus, met together in their comfortable homes, and just shared the story of Jesus over and over among themselves and felt really good about it. What if they'd have done that? The growth would have stopped. The Church of Jesus Christ would have died in the first century. Isn't this the same choice we're facing today? Isn't it the question that the church has always been facing every generation for 2,000 years? Are we willing to adapt and change and respond? You see, as I thought through this, the question came to my mind, what are we unwilling to change if it means that we cease to exist or are completely irrelevant and impotent in the next 10, 20, 30 years? What is so valuable, what is so important to us that we say, I'm unwilling to move this, even to the detriment of other people? You see, I get it. We want comfort. We want familiar. But we have to acknowledge, as we've already said, the world is changing rapidly. What worked 50 years ago doesn't work today. And I'm not saying we change the message, because the message of Jesus always stays the same. But how we present that message might need to change. I hear stories right now in the Christian movement around the world that's reaching people through electronic dance music. You know, EDM, you know that... You know, that kind of thing. You know, and I have to ask myself, here's a legitimate question. I wrote it in my notes. It says, am I willing to dye my hair blue, cut my hair into a mohawk, and go dance in a mosh pit of Jesus music to see someone come to Jesus? That's an extreme example, right? Now you're trying to picture me with a blue mohawk. It's pretty attractive, isn't it? I mean, I get it. It looks good on me. Now that may be extreme, but you know what? There are some that are called to that. Others are called to just be willing to let go of some of the methods of the past in order to be able to tell somebody new about Jesus. One of the commentaries, the New International Commentary on Acts, I was reading it this week for this message. And the author wrote this. He said, established Christians are often unwilling to change practices in their church in order to welcome converts. Forms of worship, styles of music, time of worship service, and so on may need to be adjusted to accommodate non-Christians so that they feel at home and may be better served. Many Christians say they are committed to evangelism, but they do not want to pay the price of bringing in the evangelistic harvest. In actuality, they want to be comfortable. But God has not called us to comfort, but to witness to everyone about Jesus Christ. We are in a generation where more and more young people, and I say young people, I'm 45, so anybody 44 and under qualifies, are moving away from faith. They're checking that no affiliation box. That number's not going down. It's getting larger. Some of your own children and grandchildren aren't connected to a community of faith. Let me ask you, what are you unwilling to do if it would mean that your kids and grandkids would make Jesus a priority in their lives again? What are you unwilling to change? You know, sometimes, even over the last 7 years as I've been lead pastor, the world has moved. The world has changed. And it might be time for fresh solutions even here for us to make more room for people to follow Jesus. You know, I love verse 7. So the word of God spread. And isn't that what we want? The number of disciples in Jerusalem increased rapidly. And a large number of priests became obedient to the faith. Just think about the significance of that. These are people serving in the Jewish temple, the Jewish synagogues. They are the committed, and they decide to follow Jesus. If we respond to changes in cultures, if we're willing to serve one another both inside and outside the church and show our unity in our diversity, I'm confident the number of those following Jesus will increase. You see, as the writer of Acts, Luke, writes this, these are not past tense verbs. They are imperfect tense, indicating to us that they are continuous, growing, increasing. Wasn't an end. You see, it's not an either-or situation, but a both-and. Looking after one another like a family and making room for others to become part of this family. You see, maybe you're here today and you hear this message and you think, well, I like the church that you're talking about, but my experience has been a little different. I want to invite you to give church another shot. Give Ashworth a shot, as imperfect as we will be, and I will promise you, we will let you down. We will disappoint you. I will blow your minds with how ungodly I can be sometimes. No amens from the staff on that one. But this is what Jesus left in his unfinished work. And he wants us to be a family. And maybe you need and you desire that family, but you've been burned by church. Let me encourage you. Take a step. Trust again. And see if we can't be a community of people together working to look more like this. Loving and caring for one another. I hope Ashworth could be a place for you, imperfect as it is, a place for you to belong. For the rest of us, I think today we need to consider how are we responding to these things on the screen? Are we helping build unity or are we tearing it down? Sometimes we need to really evaluate that. Man, the Bible talks a lot about our tongue. You know why? Because it'll get you in trouble faster than anything else. Are you outside yaying about stuff you don't like? Stop it. It's not building unity. May not like everything that's going on. I don't like everything that's going on. But it doesn't mean I sit here and tear it down. Because I do believe God is doing something. And I believe God has led me here. So I want to be a part of what God is doing here. What about serving? I told Ryan before the service today, I said, this is the tough one for me because I think about our church and we had a volunteer appreciation banquet a few weeks ago. We sent out over 120 invitations. That's a really big number because I know a lot of you are already serving. Maybe you're sitting on the sidelines. It's very easy to come into church and sit on the sidelines and be a consumer of the Christian products. That doesn't help build the church. That last one, are you open to change when necessary? I know change is scary, and a lot of times the conventional wisdom says you only change when the pain of staying the same gets too great. What if we didn't believe that? What if we didn't live there? What if we said, you know what, our motivation for change is not pain of staying, but it's the potential of what could be. It's the potential of being able to reach someone else for Jesus, to tell them about how Jesus changes lives. And we can see marriages restored and families healed and lives transformed. Could that be our motivation to change rather than just waiting for the pain to hit in? I want you to know that if God continues to bring people to Ashworth, it will require us to change. But what is better, holding on to what was and what has been so we can be comfortable and embrace, or embracing the potential of what can be? A vibrant church where people meet Jesus and lives are changed. You know, sometimes I realize comfort is a great draw for us. But I just close with this final thought. We need to think about this in light of Jesus and really be glad that he didn't choose his own comfort over the cross.